Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. Coming up in this edition, we'll be hearing about a merger between the West Sussex and Brighton and Hove branches of Age UK. And we'll be talking to a man who lives in Shoreham, who has the unusual hobby of inventing TV quizzes. Then we'll be finding out about some factors that can affect the self-confidence of women once they get past the age of 50, and what can be done about it. And on a lighter note, we'll be talking to the founder of the distillery which produces Brighton Gin. As usual, we'll be giving out various phone numbers, email addresses, and website addresses during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's get started with Age UK. Just recently, the West Sussex and Brighton and Hove branches of Age UK decided to merge. And having done so, they then started a consultation to find out what their customers would like them to concentrate on. To find out more about both these topics, I went along to Age UK's office in Prestonville Road, just off Seven Dials, and there I met Helen Rice, who was chief executive of the West Sussex branch and is now the chief executive of the combined branch. I put it to Helen that these must be exciting times.
Exciting, yeah, really exciting time for us. I started in the role on the 1st of March, and on the 2nd of March we started a conversation about a merger for Brighton and Hove. And we really did have great teams on either side saying, we're all here for the same thing. We want to deliver better for older people, and we think we can do that better together. So we made that merger happen really fast. So we completed the merger on the 30th of June, and we're now in that kind of post-merger stage where we're ironing out things and, you know, working out systems. You'll soon find, in about 6 months' time, I should think, a new website, and there'll be hopefully even a new charity name. We'll wait and see, but really exciting time for us.
Now, Age UK is a national charity, and you're a local organisation. How does that fit in with you using the same name?
Age UK is a national charity, you're absolutely right, and we are what you call brand partners. So we are their local organisations on the ground, and we choose to be a partner of Age UK National and choose to use their name. And in that relationship, they support us around really important things like policy work, campaigns and support. And we operate as an independent charity on the ground and are delivering, we're delivering to about 15,000 people across West Sussex and Brighton and Hove together. And it's wonderful. It's a really great partnership, because what it means is that we can have all the learning from National, but yet we can be completely independent locally and respond to the needs of older people on a local basis.
So you get the best of both worlds, really.
Yes, absolutely. So it really does work for us here, and people understand the brand and know what it is. So that's also very useful to us. But we'll see whether we adopt a new charity name, probably, I should think, next spring if we do, because Age UK West Sussex and Brighton and Hove is a little bit of a mouthful.
It is rather, isn't it?
So yes, that's the next thing that we're working on, along with a really wide-ranging consultation, so that we can form a new strategic plan for the merged organisation, which we're hoping to launch about the 1st of April next year.
So who are you consulting?
As many people as we possibly can, because for us, we're only here to serve the people that we're here to serve. So it starts with the grassroots up. So first of all, who's using our services now? Who isn't using our services, but they might like to know more or might like to inform what we do in the future? And then obviously my amazing volunteer army. We've got nearly 450 volunteers, and we always want more. So please let us know if you want to volunteer and help us out. Our staff team, which is almost 150 staff, and our trustee board, obviously, and our, which is, you know, crucial, because they're there to hold the organisation and the governance of it, and obviously the wider stakeholders. There are funders and politicians and councillors, etc., who are wonderfully supportive of our work. So we want to hear from all of those different bodies, and of course health services and, you know, the NHS, to make sure that we design and develop our organisation in the way that everyone needs us to for the future.
And what sort of things are you hoping to find out from the people you consult?
Well, I'd really like to find out about what people are going to want in the future, because the world changes constantly, as we all know. So what people might have wanted from us 5-10 years ago may be very different now. People may not want any of the same services. They may say, actually, our challenges now are different. We require a different response. And I really want to know what those are, because we're trying to... You can never completely future-proof something, but we'd like to make sure that... You know, we're moving in the right direction. I mean, presently, we have a huge range of services. You know, we start from information and advice, making sure that people have, you know their rights and their responsibilities, and also understand things that are affecting their life, like, you know, things to do with the benefit system or housing or the care system, for example. Then also we're working in hospitals. We're also working in GP surgeries. So, for example, if you fell over and were in hospital, we'd take you home and settle you in at home and also support you in a wider way. And we also work doing sort of linking between the health service and the social sector, if you like. So that's social prescribing, community linking workers, and then we've got all these amazing activities happening. So you could go to one of our centres, which are Brighton and Hove, obviously, where we are sat right now. We also have an office in Littlehampton and Chichester. We've also got centres in Bognor, in Crawley, in Burgess Hill and Haywards Heath, and multitudes of activity clubs. And of course we also have a dementia service, which supports carers and people with dementia across the county and in Brighton and Hove. And we're also, obviously, have other services which we charge for.
Yes, I was just going to ask, are all these services free?
An awful lot of them are. So we do everything in our powers to get as much money from different places to pay for everything. People are very generous and very kind, and a lot of people pay a small amount of money to be a member of one of our activity centres. So, for example, if you're a member of our gym in Bognor Regis, it costs you £17 a month. I don't know where else you get a gym membership for £17. So we're trying to keep our costs at a point that we have maximum accessibility. But obviously there's other things such as help at home. So if you wanted to buy a cleaning service from us, a handyman, gardening service, shopping service, those things we do at home. And also we have a separate trading company which sits alongside our charity here in West Sussex and Brighton and Hove, which sells insurance products. So if you bought insurance through us, any money that we make that's a surplus gets gift aided to the charity. And we also sell lottery tickets, which also brings us a really nice income in as well. So loads of different ways that people support us, and we do events and things to help bring money in, as you know.
And of course people can help you by becoming volunteers, can't they?
Oh, they absolutely can. Absolutely essential. We are half our services would not be running without volunteers. We've got about 450 volunteers, and that fluctuates, obviously, but we're always wanting more. So Richard, our volunteer manager, will always want to hear from you if you want to take part in our services and support us, or bring your special skills in to help us. Everything from people coming and helping us paint to supporting our advice service, to have support our hospital service. It's been fantastic. So thank you to all of the people that volunteer now and anyone who fancies it in the future.
You can always do with more, can't you?
Oh, always. The demand is, you know, if you look at the demand for our advice services, it's incredible. So, we're here to do as much as we possibly can to meet that need.
So if people want to volunteer, or indeed if they want to take part in the consultation, how should they get in touch?
So obviously go to our websites, and there's an online, you know, form. We're also going to be running events, so we will let people know about those. You'll see us at older people's festivals, or if there's anything happening out in the community, we have a huge amount of coverage. So just go over and say, how can I get involved in the consultation? Or you can give us a phone. So you could call our number in West Sussex on 01903 731 800 and ask for Vicky, or you could call our Brighton number 01273 720 603 and say, how can I get involved in your consultation? We'd love to hear from you.
And what's the website address?
Yes, it's www.agukwestsussex.org.uk. I'd go to the central one there. There is a separate Brighton Hove address, but I'd just go to, it's got the same information on, so go to that one and you'd get everything you need.
I was talking to Helen Rice, the CEO of HUK West Sussex and Brighton, about the newly merged organisation and about the consultation that they're holding into what people would like them to concentrate on in the future. If you'd like more information, you can go to their website, which is www.hukwestsussex.org.uk. That's www.hukwestsussex.org.uk. Or you can phone them, and there are two possible phone numbers. For Brighton, you can phone 01273 720603. That's 01273 720603. Or for West Sussex, you can phone 01903 731 800. That's 01903 731 800. Now, our next item was first broadcast in May of last year. Here's Maya Davis.
At some time or another, I'm sure we've all caught an episode of a daytime or tea time quiz programme. There are lots of different ones. I won't bother to go and list them all. I've probably missed some out anyway. But you might be wondering who dreams up these formats and how they get aired. Well, one person who knows some of the answers is Shoreham resident Colin Johnson, and he's with me today. So welcome, Colin. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Now, tell me, how did your interest in quiz devising actually start?
Well, back in the 80s, I was sitting watching a quiz one day. I've always enjoyed watching quizzes on TV. And I was sitting there and I thought to myself, anyone could do this. You don't need any special training or any special qualifications. It's not like being a brain surgeon where you have to go away to college for 7 years and stuff. Anyone can invent a TV quiz format. And I don't see why I shouldn't, because I reckon I've seen enough quizzes and I understand what's involved. So I had it in mind to do that. And then one day I was having a drink with a friend at lunchtime, and he told me that he knew Don McLean, the Brummy comedian. And Don was looking for a new quiz show as a way of getting back on television. And I think I probably had a pint or two to drink because I said, oh, I'll invent one for him. But that gave me a purpose. And I did invent one, and I did get to show it to Don.
And what happened?
Well, he loved it. He thought it was ideal just as it was. I'd done a little mock-up on my Amstrad computer, and he loved it. And he said, you know, let's try and get someone interested in it. And I said, how do you do that? Because I don't know. I assumed he did because he was very experienced in TV, and he claimed that he did. He told me later on he hadn't a clue. but he arranged for us to meet one or two people in ITV, and they were quite complimentary about it, but said that there just wasn't a slot, an opportunity at that time. And then he got a chance to meet the head of light entertainment at BBC Television at the Television Centre, and he said that he liked it, but he thought it was a daytime quiz, and he rang up his friend Dave Ross, who ran quizzes for daytime, and Dave took one look at it, and he loved it too. So this is all going quite swimmingly, and he said he was going to put a series of 12 programmes on, and we thought this is wonderful. I thought he would probably want to do a pilot, but he said, no, can't afford a pilot. We'll do a series of 12.
And it just ran like that?
Well, it might have done. What actually happened was about a week or so later, he rang me up and said he'd changed his mind.
Oh, how disappointing.
Which was very disappointing. But he then said, I don't want 12, I want 32.
Ah.
And that's actually what happened. And they produced a series of 32 programmes, which went out in almost exactly 25 years ago to the day, March 1993.
Good grief. And what was that quiz called?
So it was called First Letter First.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the contestants had a keyboard, and the question was asked, and they had to press the first letter of the answer on the keyboard.
Right.
And then they got to collect the letters, and then they had to make them into a word of four letters or more. Okay. And that was the basic idea behind it.
Mm-hmm.
There were one or two other bits and pieces, but it seemed to work quite well.
How did you go about devising that format then?
Well, I was on holiday in France, and I was thinking about Countdown and the fact that I like word games and anagrams. And then I don't quite know where I got the switch to the idea of the first letter of the answer coming in, but it was basically by thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And with any of these quizzes, you've got to have that sort of big idea, but it's then a lot of work in actually devising the different rounds and sample questions and everything else.
So what do you think are the characteristics of a good format?
Ah, well, it has to be simple. It has to be very easy to understand. It has to be entertaining. It has to be distinctive. And I think perhaps the most important thing is it has to be fun to play along with.
Mm. So you devise your formats based on those ideas, and how do you then try them out?
Well, a lot of people, I think, pitch the ideas without trying them out, but I always feel it's important to try them out, and I try them out with friends. Most of my friends are quite used to being given a call and asked if they'd like to come along and try something out, and most of them do it in good humour.
And what happens after that? You try it out for the first time with friends, and then...
And then you usually get some feedback, and as a result of that feedback, I need to change it, so I need to do another run-through. And that whole process can take months, if not years, to get it right. That's not the way it happened with the first quiz. With the first quiz, I got it pretty much right first time, and it all went through really well, and I thought, this is easy. And for the last 25 years, I've been trying to replicate that success, working very hard at a number of different quiz ideas, and not one of them has got on air.
Oh dear, so you haven't managed to sell any more formats?
No, I've had a lot of fun along the way, and I now regard it very much as about the journey rather than the destination. So I enjoy the process.
And what do your friends think about it?
Well, I mean, they seem to enjoy it, and they seem to think that there's something there. And most of my friends are not afraid to say if there are bits they don't like, which is actually helpful, as long as they don't overdo it. and most of them seem to be willing to come back and do it more than once, so presumably they are interested in the experience.
You say none of them's actually got to air. Have you had any nibbles from anyone?
Well, I had a lot of interest in a format I invented about 10 years ago, which is called Vicious Circle. That basically is based on the idea of a board game. You have a circle of contestants on the floor, each on their own spot, and as they get a question right, they move forward, and if they land on another player, they kind of take that player and they get eliminated from the game.
Ooh.
And that was the basic idea behind Vicious Circle.
That does sound vicious.
It does, doesn't it? Yes. And that would have been quite interesting visually, I think. And it certainly caught a lot of people's imagination. We showed it to a lot of broadcasters, and we had varying amounts of interest. Mm. And there was a production company who thought it was a real winner, because it was very distinctive. We took it to the industry exhibition in Cannes.
Ooh.
Which was good fun. So like the Cannes Television Festival. I got to do a bit of jetting around to different countries, showing it to them. You've got to Dubai, for example, and Barcelona.
Excellent. When you say we, who's we?
Me working with a TV production company.
Oh,
because
I see.
Basically, someone like myself doesn't go directly to a broadcaster. I need to go through and with a TV production company.
And how do you find that production company?
There are lists online of different production companies, and I usually get on the phone and ring up and say, who's your creative director? Can I come and see you and show my idea? And usually they're very receptive because they need new ideas.
Oh, right. Okay. So what do you enjoy most about devising these formats?
There are kind of three phases.
Mm-hmm.
And the first phase is where I'm working on my own at home, where I've got total control and developing different ideas and trying them out. The second phase is when I'm working with a TV production company, where they will have their ideas and they're in control, and I've sort of had to give up my baby, but I can see it's looking prettier as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pitching to TV companies, and then hopefully it gets accepted, and then the third phase is production. I was lucky enough with First Letter First to actually be in the studio working on it during the recording of all the different shows, and that was the most exciting thing.
Right. Do you think it's important to have prizes in these competitions?
It depends on the type of quiz, because if you talk about quizzes like Mastermind and Only Connect, which are very challenging and difficult quizzes, then it really isn't about the prizes at all. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the mindless game shows, and that's very often all about the money. And in the middle, you have the accessible general knowledge quiz shows, which is the sort that I'm interested in. And I don't think it matters very much. I mean, you know, very often the prize is £1,000 or something, and it's not really for the prize, it's for the honour of winning.
I see. Now, you mentioned accessible quiz shows. Does that mean that that's the sort of question you ask?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Now, have you ever actually run a quiz yourself?
Oh, this is something I do as a hobby. I've been running quizzes for 20 or 30 years for local clubs and charities.
Okay, so what's the largest one you've ever run then?
The largest one was, I can remember the date exactly because it's an unusual date. It's the 29th of February 1996.
Okay.
Which was the year of the Olympics, of course. And it was in the days before lottery-funded Olympics. And so the British Olympic Appeal needed to raise funds. And I ran a quiz for them. And we had 64 teams of four. We had exactly 256 contestants.
Where was this?
This was in the Arts Centre at Stratford-upon-Avon. That was good fun.
What do you enjoy most? Setting, devising, taking part, asking the questions?
I definitely enjoy asking the questions more than answering the questions. Mainly because when I'm asking the questions, I have the answer in front of me. And I can be in control of the whole process. But I love devising quizzes as well.
Do you have any ambitions now, apart from obviously getting a quiz on the telly again?
Well, that's the big ambition. And I would just love to be in the studio, seeing my show being broadcast. And that's the driving force behind what I do, much more than any money I might make out of it. But it's about the journey, the whole process. I love devising the quizzes. I love programming them. I love trying them out with friends, showing them off to production companies. So no, that keeps me very happy.
Well, that sounds as though you've got an awful lot to keep you going for a very long time.
I think so.
It keeps your brain active too, I would think.
Well, that's another thing. Yes, it's got to be useful from that point of view.
Well, that's an interesting insight into the world of devising quizzes. Thank you very much, Colin.
That's a great pleasure.
Maya Davis was talking to Shoreham resident Colin Johnson, who has the unusual hobby of designing TV quizzes. Now, a recent survey by the organisation HealthSpan has brought to light the fact that women's self-confidence tends to decrease quite rapidly once they pass the age of 50. To find out more about it, Chris English spoke on the telephone to the psychologist Dr. Meg Arroll, and he began by asking her to tell him more about the survey.
The HealthSpan survey found that 35% of women have struggled emotionally with the perimenopause and menopause, and that's over a third Also, 31% of women from Brighton feel the impact of the menopause is underrated, which goes to show that women are not feeling heard during this time in their lives.
And what can we men do about this? Can we help?
Oh, without a doubt. So be in those conversations, first and foremost. Do some research. There is quite a lot of information on healthspan.co.uk. Be educated about it. Also, be patient, really. It can take some time for women to find treatment options that really suit them. Every woman is individual, and it may be a mixture of HRT, say, with some psychological therapies, also nutritional support in the terms of supplements. So patience is absolutely key. Also, I would say to men, don't take things personally. We do know that mood disruption is a common symptom of the menopause. So if your partner is lashing out a bit, take a step back and just think it may be due to the hormonal fluctuations and not to do with what you're doing.
Is this a general thing? I mean, you talked about women in Brighton, but is it something that's inevitable as you get older?
Well, so 80% of women will experience disruptive symptoms associated with the menopause. So, yes, it's very high, but it's not everyone. And the variability in symptoms is wide. So some women will just have a few symptoms and they won't want to seek medical support for. Other women have such severe symptoms that they give up work. It can lead to the breakdown in relationships. It can affect their daily functioning. So it is a serious problem that we should be talking about more openly, without a doubt.
I mean, for most men, it's something of a closed book, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, we as professionals need to help open up those conversations with men. We need to help men to know how to support their partners. Absolutely. This is something that I'm very passionate about. And we, without a doubt, need a campaign specifically for men to look at how they can help. Because otherwise, as you say, men can feel like whatever the response from their partner is, it's something to do with them. They're to blame. And actually, once symptoms are either alleviated by treatment or if they naturally come to a close, those issues within a relationship, they can disappear. So it's a period of time that we all need to be understanding. And women also need to be understanding of the impact that their symptomology can have on men too.
And is it a sort of a lifelong thing as far as the menopause is concerned? Is every woman going to suffer from it?
No. As I said, about 80% of women will suffer from disruptive symptoms. Obviously, all women will experience the menopause, but whether the symptoms affect you physically, emotionally, and psychologically, it is individual. So this is one of the problems, actually, because women can talk to their friends, they can look for information online, and sometimes it doesn't always feel relatable. So we've tried quite hard at Healthspan to give a range of information to really speak to individual women in a more personalised approach.
And as far as your professional activities are concerned, as a psychologist, is it difficult getting through to people these facts and figures?
I don't think it's difficult to get through to people the facts and figures. I think sometimes you can know something sort of intellectually and in a more abstract way. Whether that sinks in and you feel that that's relevant to your experience is a completely different thing. Often women who are experiencing symptoms in the perimenopause may not realize that's the cause. And so especially issues like anxiety, depression, sleep problems, because they're not the classic hot flushes or night sweats that we associate with the menopause. So they may not know exactly what's going on. And that's why we do need to talk more openly about this.
And you mentioned earlier a website where people can get details. Can you repeat that?
That is healthspan.co.uk.
Dr. Meg, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris English was talking to Dr. Meg Arrell about self-confidence problems which may affect women in later years. The website she mentioned, at which you can find out more information, is healthspan.co.uk. That's healthspan, which is spelt healthspan.co.uk. Well, from an item like that one, you might get the impression that life is not good for women over 50, which of course is not the case at all. One organisation determined to prove that is the Women Over 50 Film Festival, which has been running in Brighton for a few days in September for the last 5 years, if my calculations are correct. In a future programme, the brains behind it, Noella O'Sullivan, will be coming into our studio to tell us all about this year's festival. But as a foretaste of that, I thought perhaps you might like to hear what she told me a couple of years ago about how the festival came into being.
It was just an idea a friend of mine and I had, sitting talking in a pub one night, thinking that we just weren't seeing enough older faces on our screen. And also from my experience of going to film festivals, I wasn't seeing very many older women in the festival audience or seeing details about them from behind the camera. And I just thought, well, you know, I'm not going to have it, this. And I decided with my friend that we would put out a call, see if anybody wants to send us films by or about older women. And we had a lovely one-day event in the Exeter Street Hall, Community Hall. That very first year, we got 68 films, and we showed 27 of them to an audience of 80 people. We got 80 people in an 80-seater hall. So even from those tiny beginnings, we knew that there was something there. We knew that women wanted to send us work, and we knew that people wanted to see this work. And that's really the kind of crucial thing to learn in the first year. The rules are very simple. The film either has to have an older woman, a woman over 50, at the centre of the piece on screen, or there has to be a woman over 50 in the core creative team behind the camera. So that's the producer, the director or the writer.
That was Noella O'Sullivan talking about the Women Over 50 Film Festival, which she founded. This year's festival runs from the 20th to the 22nd of September, and Noella will be coming into our studio before that to give us more information. We're going to finish this edition of At Home This Morning on a slightly alcoholic note. You may have noticed that over the last year or so, gin, which once was a very fashionable drink but went out of fashion, has become fashionable again. New small distilleries have been popping up all over the country, including one in Brighton, which produces a drink simply called Brighton Gin. In October of last year, Chris English went along to their headquarters to talk to the distiller, Josh Harvey, and he began by asking him how his product differed from the others.
Brighton Gin is a wonderfully perceived handcrafted gin made in Brighton by a team of about 5 or 6 full-time members of staff. It's a very smooth, citrus-driven spirit, obviously with lots of juniper on there, all handcrafted in Brighton and Hove, and something we are very, very proud of.
What makes Brighton Gin? How does the process work?
So what we do is we have an organic grain spirit, which comes across from Italy, and we take that, we distill it with 6 botanicals.
What are botanicals?
Botanicals are any part of plant. So it can range from bark to leaves to fruits and pretty much everything in between. So we're using 6 of these. 2 of them are wonderful citruses, orange and lime peel. We also have milk thistle. Milk thistle is grown in Sussex and the South Downs, and it's known as a liver cleanser. Some people take their milk thistle tablets in the morning. We thought it would be a great thing to add to the gin. It also has some wonderfully nutty notes to it that we think works perfectly, complements the juniper that goes into the gin also.
There have been claims recently that you can use gin as a slimming aid. Is that just a figment of somebody's wish?
There's a claim that gin does lots and lots of things for you. It actually all goes back through the history of gin. The reason gin first came about was actually from the Dutch. The Dutch created a spirit called Geneva. Geneva had juniper in it, and juniper was meant to be wonderful for stomach ailments, stomach cramps, glandular problems, and a whole range of things. So that's where gin started. So people have always said that it's a healthy drink. As that goes, I'm not too sure. But it was then added, we then added citrus. The British added some form of citrus to fight against vitamin C deficiency, scurvy, and then finally tonic water was added. Tonic water has quinine in it, and quinine is meant to fight malaria and fevers.
And cramp.
Exactly that. So have a G&T, and yeah, some people, well, historically, you would like to think that it is healthy for you.
The process here is quite small, really.
It is, yeah. Yeah, we are a very small company. It's something we're very, very proud of, to be able to develop this with five full-time members of staff who are Brightonians, who are all passionate about gin. And that's what we were all about, is actually developing a product from people that live in Brighton, for people in Brighton, and not just in Brighton, throughout the UK and throughout the world, really, is we wanted to share our passion of this delicious, smooth spirit, and we really wanted it to try and reach the masses.
Now, there's a lot of gins out there. I mean, it's become the in thing in the last, what, 5 years, something like that?
Yeah, coming up to 10, I think, yeah. Now. There was a law change recently. The minimum still size in the UK was 1,800 litres. Very large sort of factory size. And that law actually got changed in 2009 with there being no minimum still size. So that's allowed for lots and lots of people to start producing gin. And yes, we are part of that. And we think we've got a wonderful gin. It's proving very popular. Still very smooth and full of wonderful flavour.
How much Brighton gin do you produce?
So each batch of our Brighton gin is 250 litres. At the moment, we're producing about three of those a week. So we're producing about 750 litres a week. That's probably getting us around 1,000 bottles a week. So it's enough. Don't get me wrong, if sales, some sales weeks are good, some sales weeks aren't so strong, so it will vary around that. But normally, I'd say, yeah, around 750 litres of gin a week.
So, I mean, we're here in what you call the gin cave.
The gin cave, yes, we do.
And sort of people are working around us. And there's a few bottles over there, a few cases over there, but not huge stocks.
Being quite a small company as well, our stock levels obviously aren't too large. And to be honest, we don't have too much room to be storing it all. So it's a case of storing enough gin in advance, but also always looking into future production and to keeping on sort of top of production. We've always got enough gin that if it is needed to be produced, if we do have a large order come in, we would be able to make it up, and within sort of 24 to 48 hours, that would be ready in bottles to go out the door. So the process can be, you know, we can keep up with production if needs be.
Has it got a shelf life? Will it go off?
No. Lucky enough, because it is 40% alcohol, the alcohol will keep it good. Yeah, there's no problem with it. I've actually had my auntie recently came up to me and gave me a bottle of gin, and she said, "I think this has gone off." And I very happily took it off her hands because I knew that it hadn't. So that is the great thing about gin. Even if you've opened it up, as long as the cork's in the top, the gin won't go off. If the cork's out, then some of the alcohol may evaporate off. So I'd recommend keep the cork in and you're good to go.
But only evaporate. It doesn't actually deteriorate in terms of it'll poison you.
No, not at all. No. If the gin was distilled right, bottled right, and everything in the distillery has undergone the right process, then there is nothing that will change over time to contaminate that gin.
You're in the top end of the market with Brighton Gin, aren't you, for gins? I mean, there's a lot of them about. Was that a deliberate policy?
For us, it was something we enjoyed drinking ourselves, and for something that we feel our audience would also enjoy. We feel that this, by targeting it where we have, we feel balanced in with some of the other gins available on the market, but we also feel that it will, that a lot of people will be able to try it and appreciate it. What we've actually tried to do is price in a range that we feel with the time, the hours that we put into the process, that we feel is...
It fits into a particular slot. You're not aiming to be one of the top producers that we won't mention brand names, but a very popular one that I'm sure a lot of people have heard of. But they are producing thousands of gallons almost a day, aren't they?
Yes, definitely. I mean, yes, some people are producing what we produce here in a year in a day. So the scales are completely different, but there are, I mean, we like to call ourselves a craft gin, and that what that does mean is everything is handcrafted by the small team that is here. As when you do scale up into a much larger distillery, some of those handcrafted elements change. So for us, that's what we really wanted to keep in our product. By having hands involved in the process from start to finish, we can ensure that the quality of our liquid is going to be as high as possible, that we can really focus on everything that happens throughout the process, meaning that once it is in the bottle and goes out to the public, that each bottle that they try will always be consistently delicious.
I mean, the point about small batches, can you be sure that each one tastes the same?
You can't be sure of it, and in fact, batches can change in flavour, but that's where our job really comes to life, is we need to make sure that we are controlling these flavour changes during the process. So my best part of the day, I get to come into the job, come into work at 8 in the morning, try a little bit of gin, make sure that I'm happy with the flavour, make sure that the flavour is consistent to what we're used to. If there is any variable, then and we're not happy with the gin, we won't bottle it. It will not become Brighton gin. So we are very sure to make sure that only the best quality or the quality that we agree with will be bottled. That makes sure that the audience, the people that buy the bottles, are always going to get that consistent, delicious flavour.
The product is really only available in certain selected either pubs or bars or supermarkets. Again, is that a deliberate move?
Yes, I mean, being a handcrafted spirit, I think it would be quite interesting to be able to almost get it anywhere. And for us, you know, we really wanted to, what's the word I'm looking for here? We wanted to grow with the community around us, with the area we're from, and really grow organically. We wanted to make sure that we are in, again, locally in bars and in restaurants. Hopefully you'll find us in the majority of them, because again, we want to support the people around us, the businesses around us, being that we are from Brighton. And yes, if you had then found us in all your supermarkets, then that does take away from the fact that we are a local handcrafted product. So you will find us in a few, but not in all.
Select,
exactly that, yes.
And finally, Josh, gin has been labelled Mother's Ruin. How did that come about?
So that again comes back in the history of it, going back when they basically introduced these laws. They introduced 8 gin acts to stop us drinking as much gin as we were. And this was back in sort of the mid-1700s. What, unfortunately, people didn't realise the medical properties behind gin, or the lack of, shall we say. So mothers were drinking copious amounts of this quite strong alcohol, and unfortunately it wasn't doing very good to them. And it was, yeah, very much mother's ruin, mothers dropping babies, as we've heard in stories from back in the day, and all this kind of stuff that really was actually happening.
But that won't happen with Brighton gin.
Won't happen with Brighton gin. I mean, we always like to say, please drink responsibly. But no, it's, I mean, again, it depends how much you drink. It could ruin some mothers. But no, we'd like to say that everyone's going to drink it responsibly and enjoy the product rather than drinking as much as possible.
And the future?
The future is hopefully looking similar to what we're doing at the moment. Again, for us, as I mentioned, we are a small team. We are hopefully going to continue to do this for a while. That is the one thing I do, or one of the many things I do love about Brighton Gin, is that we are all very, very passionate about what we do, and we are all hopefully going to be doing this for a very long time. We enjoy it, we love it, why would we try and change it?
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, pleasure.
Chris English was talking to Josh Harvey, the founder of Brighton Gin. And that interview brings our programme to an end for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks' time. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch to let me know what you think of the programme, or perhaps to suggest items that you might like me to cover in the future, I'd be glad to hear from you. You can email me via the Radio Reverb website. If you find the page devoted to At Home This Morning, it'll give you an opportunity to send me a message. And you can also email me via the website of Grey Matters Productions, the group who produce this programme for Radio Reverb. Our email address is info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, I-N-F-O, at greymattersproductions.org.uk. And whichever method you choose, I'd love to hear from you. From me and from everybody at Grey Matters Productions, until we meet again, goodbye and take care.